Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky on the racism, cynicism, and hypocrisy of the Republican Party from the 1970s to today. And Eve Ottenberg saying something pretty similar about today's Democrats. I hope you'll stay tuned. In 2021, America's preeminent public intellectual, Noam Chomsky, is 92 years old. Amazingly, he comes across not only as lucid, but as still brilliant. On June 1, he spoke by phone with podcast host David Pakman. Chomsky starts with a fascinating account of the evolution of the GOP, the Republican Party, over the past 50 years. As Chomsky tells it, the GOP's core aims and values are unchanged, advancing the interests of the big corporations and the rich at the expense of the workers. But that's not a platform for winning elections in a democracy. So, with great cynicism and hypocrisy, the GOP adopted racism, then an anti-abortion stance, a pro-gun rights stance, and denial of climate change. As Chomsky sees it, the GOP powers that be don't actually believe in any of these hot-button issues. They just pretend to so they can get elected and further cut the taxes on the rich. It's a fascinating impromptu history lesson and well worth hearing. New World Notes does not champion any political party. In the interests of fairness and balance, we note, at the national level, the Democrats are almost as bad, hypocritical, and cynical as the Republicans. After Chomsky, I will read a short essay by Eve Ottenberg on the hypocrisy and cynicism of Mr. Biden and the Democratic senators. But on the principle of age before beauty, we'll start with Noam Chomsky and the GOP. David Pakman begins.
It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program today Noam Chomsky, one of the most renowned intellectuals of our time and author of over 25 books, including Chomsky for Activists, Universalizing Resistance. Professor, it's so great having you on today. I appreciate it.
Very pleased to be with you.
So I would love to start by getting your thoughts about how the current state of the American right and the Republican Party got to where it is today. There's this line that is sometimes traced that goes back to anger stemming from the civil rights movement into the Reagan era of being against welfare through to the Gingrich era of the early 90s and radicalization and this sort of progression that led to the Trumpian era. How do you see this progression of the last 40, 50 years?
That's a pretty accurate description. Goes back to Richard Nixon, who recognized that the Republican Party could pick up Southern Democratic votes by essentially being a racist party. Didn't put it in those words, of course, but essentially by, in various indirect fashions, making it clear that they opposed the civil rights movement. There had been a solid Democratic bloc of Southern Democrats. They were strongly opposed to the Johnson support for the early civil rights movement, and this was called Nixon's Southern Strategy. And nothing secret about it. It was quite open. We have to recognize that the Republicans have a certain problem. Of the two political parties, they are the one that is more supportive of business rights and the very rich. And you can't approach voters saying, I want to support the very rich and the corporate world and harm you, so please vote for me. That obviously doesn't work.
No.
So you have to look for other issues, what are called cultural issues, things that are apart from the actual programs of the party. The programs of the party are very clear. Strong support for extreme wealth and corporate power. It's perfectly obvious during the Trump years. The one legislative achievement was a tax bill that benefited the extreme rich and extreme wealth, and a cutback of corporate taxes, deregulation of sports business, and so on. You can't approach voters that way. So they've had to look for something else. Well, Nixon's Southern strategy was a start. In the mid-1970s, a leading Republican strategist, Paul Weyrich, who's a Christian nationalist, he realized that if the Republicans pretended to be opposed to abortion, I stress pretended, they could pick up the huge evangelical vote and make inroads into the Northern Catholic vote. So he proposed that to the party. They all switched on a dime. They had mostly been what we now call pro-choice when Reagan was governor of California in the 1960s, passed a very strong pro-choice legislation. But in the mid-70s, they all switched entirely. Reagan, George H.W. Bush, the whole slew of them. So they became pretended anti-abortions. Then the next thing was to pick up on gun rights. They're in favor of guns. They don't care one way or another, but that's the way you can pick up more votes. And so it continues. When Reagan came along, the party became pretty openly racist. Reagan himself was a dedicated racist. He wasn't pretending. So he opened his campaign, as you recall, in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, a town which is known for only one thing. Civil rights workers were murdered there. The Republicans pretended it was an accident, but nobody could miss it.
Yeah.
Then came the stories about welfare queens, black, of course, stealing your money and so on. In fact, Reagan was so racist that he was the last leader in the world to support the apartheid regime in South Africa at a time when everyone else had left, Thatcher, Israel, everyone. Reagan was still supporting it. In fact, as late as 1988, it was all over by then. The Reagan administration declared the Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. And Mandela himself was on the terrorist list, couldn't visit the United States without special authorization for about 20 years until Congress finally passed some legislation about it. Well, so that's racism. Then comes Gingrich, who reconstructed the Congress, the Republican congressional delegation, so that it became kind of like the old Communist Party. It's a top-down organized. Everyone has to agree its role is obstructionist. That became open, not even hidden, under Mitch McConnell. When Obama was elected, McConnell came straight out and said, our task is to make sure he can do nothing. We've just seen that again now. McConnell's repeated the same point with Biden. We have to make sure we block him on everything, make the country ungovernable. And meanwhile, the policies of the party have changed as well. So, for example, in John McCain, when he ran in 2008, had a climate change plank in his program. Not very far reaching, but it was there. and the Republicans in the Senate were considering climate change legislation. The Koch brothers energy conglomerate had been working for years to ensure that the Republicans would never veer towards recognizing global warming. And they were infuriated. They launched a huge campaign, major juggernaut, bribing senators, threatening them with primary challenges, a huge lobbying campaign, AstroTurf. The Republicans totally changed. From that point on, total climate denial. That's the way it stands today.
And Professor, on that note, I think this is a really important thing, particular for my audience, which is mostly on the left to hear. You mentioned John McCain in contrast to some of these other wings of the right. There are some who recently, for example, when Mitt Romney voted to convict Donald Trump on one of those impeachment counts, or when Liz Cheney was removed from Republican leadership simply for saying, listen, Trump won, we have to accept that. There are some on the left who have reacted by saying, fundamentally, these people are no different than the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the most extreme of the Republican Party. While others believe, no, there is an important difference between people like McCain and Romney and those that have taken over the party now. Do you believe that the difference is a materially significant difference?
There is a difference. And McCain had, whatever you think about his policies, I didn't like him. I mean, criticized. But nevertheless, he was sort of a human being, decent human being in some ways, had some degree of integrity.
Yeah,
that's disappeared from the party. I mean, when you look at them now, they're virtually all cowering in terror before the Trump rebel. You can just see it in every act that they make, blocking the inquiry commission, the votes on, I mean, the votes on the stimulus were quite interesting. The Republican Party, the legislators, know very well that their own constituents largely favored the stimulus proposals. They themselves largely support them, but they voted as a block uniformly against it. You have to, the highest priority is make the country ungovernable, prevent anything from happening, find a way to get back into power so we can then worship Trump and go ahead to destroy the world. I mean, Trump's climate change policies alone, forgetting everything else, another 4 years of that would probably carry us to irreversible tipping points. The game could very well be over. And if you look at the Republican base, they're caught in this trap, a kind of an echo chamber trap. They hear the Republican leadership. Now it's Trump worship. They turn on the Fox News, reiterates it. It's an echo chamber. Listen to Rush Limbaugh when he was alive. He tells them same thing. Take a look at the attitudes. It's terrifying. So for example, there was recently a Pew poll, the main polling agency studies public attitudes. They asked people simple question. Here they gave them 15 choices to rank as which were the urgent problems that we have to face. A split between Democrats and Republicans. Among Republicans, the lowest of the 15 was climate change. 14% thought that was a serious problem. The highest problem, greatest problem we face is illegal immigration and the deficit. The deficit became a problem on November 4th.
Indeed.
Before that, it was fine. The line was, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. So Trump punched a huge hole in the deficit. That was fine. But November 4th, the Democrats, the deficit is the highest problem we face. Now, whatever you think about illegal immigration, there are problems, but nothing remotely like global warming, which is going to destroy organized human life on Earth. But that's 14%, the lowest of all the problems. Well, you put yourself in the position of a Republican voter, you can understand it. You hear Trump, you hear the Republican leadership, you listen to Fox News, they say it's just a liberal hoax. Maybe the Chinese are doing it. So what are you going to believe? That's a real, we're faced with a really serious problem. The Republican Party has just gone off the rails. Even mainstream commentators describe them as a radical insurgency which has abandoned parliamentary politics. And you can see it in the actions, particularly since Gingrich, Astor, McConnell, and so on.
I'm curious, you know, one of the toughest things that I've not even come up with any good ideas on, to be perfectly frank, is how can you do a mass deprogramming, if you consider this a brainwashing that has taken place, that could have any real impact on attitudes? I mean, even a few weeks ago, more than half of the party believes that Donald Trump is the rightful winner. Many believe that he's inevitably going to take back the White House at some point in the next year. I know that individual conversations with people, it can take months of building a relationship before you get someone to reexamine their beliefs. That's not a wholesale strategy. What do you see? Is there a way, I guess, is the question, to deal with this at a large scale?
Yes, there is. That's the strategy. And in fact, there's some positive signs. So if you look more closely at the Republican Party, the younger sectors, the millennials, they're coming to be different. It's the older part of the party that's driving towards these highly destructive policies. Among younger people, it's different. And they are reachable. It's hard work. Has to be done. Personal conversations, organization, educational programs can have an effect. We can see it ourselves. I mean, take what's the liberal population. It's quite different from what it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Take the reaction to the George Floyd murder. It's quite remarkable. The largest social movement in American history developed spontaneously. Why? Because there had been years of work to change people's attitudes and consciousness. Black Lives Matter, others, they'd prepared the ground so that when this vile murder took place, it exploded. Take the 1619 project of the New York Times. It couldn't have happened a few years ago. There's a general, steady change in consciousness. See it on many other issues. Take the recent Israeli destruction of Gaza once again. The reaction was quite different than in the past. For the first time ever, you had correspondents in the mainstream in the New York Times saying, we have to stop military aid to Israel. That would have been inconceivable a couple of years ago. And it's across the board. Take a look at evangelicals. By far the strongest support for Israel. No matter what it does, any crime is okay. Except that younger ones are moving away. Recent studies of evangelicals show that younger evangelicals are reassessing their position, rethinking this, and the same on other issues. So, the game isn't over. It's hard work, but it can be achieved. It can be achieved by sympathetic understanding of where they are, where they're coming from, finding common ground, moving towards areas which all of us can understand. And nobody wants the world to burn, to become a hothouse earth in which humans can't survive. Okay? Let's bring the understanding of this to the general population with hard work, the way it's been done on many other issues. It takes, say, feminist issues. I go back to the 1960s, they didn't exist.
Right.
Nothing. You know. Okay, now lots of understanding. So So changes can take place. In fact, it's kind of useful to go back to the 60s and see what the country was like then, before the activism of the 60s. I mean, in the 1960s, federal laws required segregation in housing. Blacks could not break into the housing market. Public housing was blocked by federal laws. We had anti-miscegenation laws that were so extreme that the Nazis wouldn't accept them. This is the 1960s, okay? All of that is inconceivable today.
Professor, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I did want to get your thoughts on, you know, some of the debates you participated in over the years with William F. Buckley, with Foucault, and so many others that still are so watched on YouTube and other platforms today. In thinking back to them now, what stands out about them? What do you remember? What seems to you to be notable about them as somebody who participated in them and was there in the room for many of those conversations?
Well, they're different. Foucault, serious person. We were talking about real issues. You can have an opinion on them. But with Buckley, it was quite different. My impression of Buckley was that he was just a fraud. I mean, he had a nice style, you know, he spoke as if he knew what he was talking about. As soon as you begin, you look at the debate, you can see it. As soon as you get into any particular issue, he quickly changes the subject because he basically doesn't know anything about it. He can try to overwhelm you with his rhetorical style and so on. I thought he was all surface. In fact, you couldn't see it in the debate, but at the end, he was so infuriated that he left the studio screaming at me, saying, you know, we'll have you back and show you a thing or two or something like that. That wasn't recorded. But my impression of him was that if he just kept calm and quiet and tried to talk about him with him about issues, it would collapse.
Noam Chomsky, who, you note, ended his history of the GOP on a hopeful note. You probably caught David Pakman's slip of the tongue when he said Trump won. He obviously meant Biden won. But maybe there's at least a small element of truth in this slip. Trump and Biden are not opposites. Trump is a politician of the far right. Biden is a politician of the center-right. Both put the interests of the big corporations and the rich ahead of the interests of the increasingly hard-pressed workers. As did Obama. So argues Eve Ottenberg in a fine essay in Counterpunch Online, June 11, 2021. I will read a condensed version of the piece. Its title is Biden's Broken Promises Spell Hard Times Ahead. Ottenberg writes, first, Biden caved on the minimum wage, then student loans, then the $300 weekly unemployment benefit, then on canceling the god-awful Trump tax cuts for billionaires, also the public option in health insurance. Biden sure was racking up a lot of things he wouldn't fight for, and guess what they all share? They're all things working people care about, vitally. Biden and the Dems may figure they can abandon workers, because who will workers turn to? Ignominious Trump? The would-be Republican Reich, devoted to worker destruction? Not likely. But Democratic-leading voters could stay home during the midterm elections next year, and, even worse for the Democratic Party, stay home in 2024. Then we'll have a one-party autocracy with giant bronze statues of Trump everywhere. Remember, Obama's betrayal of tens of millions of workers in 2009 to bail out bankers ultimately gave us Trump. And that demagogue waits in the wings. Biden's broken promises may just give Trump the opening he needs. Blaming Senator Joe Manchin and the Senate parliamentarian for Biden's broken promises is lame. A president like LBJ would have beaten both of them into shape within his first weeks in office. But Biden, like most Dems, doesn't know how to play hardball. That's because he's got one arm tied behind his back by his Wall Street donors. Only a few Dem senators don't. Biden may not be as proficient a liar as Trump, but he certainly has told some whoppers. One of the biggest was the lie that he intended to cancel student debt. At least he had the decency to try to weasel out of it. Unlike Trump, who would have flim-flammed outright that he never made such a promise. No, Biden vacillated, first revising his followers' hopes down to maybe $50,000 worth of debt. Next, he said, he'd cancel possibly $10,000 worth. But in the end, acting like the bagman for financial corporations that his enemies long claimed he was, Biden offered non-disabled student debtors who had voted for him precisely $0 of relief. So notes Eve Ottenberg in her article, Biden's Broken Promises Spell Hard Times Ahead. You can find the uncut version at counterpunch.org. It's dated June 11, 2021. Thanks also to the David Pakman Show for the Chomsky audio, which I have condensed and edited. And you can find almost every New World Notes installment at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.